Hello and welcome to Angel's Costumes Behind the Seams. I'm Jeremy Angel.
I'm Richard Green.
And I'm Jonathan Lippman. I'm thrilled that my chat today is with Lisa Duncan, who we have, Angels have just been working with on the new TV dramas directed by Steve McQueen called Small Axe. I haven't known Lisa for very long, but in the last year and a half, there have been a couple of jobs that she and I have worked together on at Angels, and we've facilitated a low-budget film and this production that's just finished shooting for presentation, I think, this autumn. But she's a lovely person to work with and very calm and very considered about her craft, and I hope that that comes across through our chat.
It very definitely does come across in the chat, actually. I think she's got a very, very healthy and very pragmatic approach to the whole thing.
Yeah.
Whether that's partly because she's, come to it having had a different career or not, I don't know. But
her career is quite interesting because if you look at the productions she's worked on, they all have a distinct look to them. They're all, some of the ones that I've seen of them, Chimerica and Informer, are extremely real and very gritty, and they're very good when you look at them. At the same time, you don't get lost in it, but it also sets the scene very well. So when you look at the work that she's done, they are really, really interesting pieces of work that she's done. But it is also, sounds an odd thing, not come from nowhere, but it's not a name. Lisa wasn't someone I knew of before I got the inquiry about Harlem Hellfighters, and that was when she was already working here before you went on with that, Jonathan. So it wasn't a name I'd seen before, but the work she's done is very good and really interesting. But as I said, it sort of came from nowhere. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I just as much as we made a discovery in terms of working with Lisa, Lisa's made a discovery in terms of working with us. And I think that for the first time in her designing career, she feels that she's in a position with budgets and the type of production that she's working on in order for her to utilize a place like Angels and our resource in terms of what that can add to her very idiosyncratic style of costuming.
The thing that's interesting as well is she did do the career she had beforehand, and it definitely, whether that has impacted how she is, but it's interesting to see how calm and organized she is from someone who hasn't come up in the chaos, and if that's the best way of putting it.
Well, her approach is very fresh, and I find talking to her and having conversations about the dynamics of what she needs to deal with quite refreshing, because I feel like I'm talking to somebody that's got a very open mind and a very open approach to how the work can proceed.
I've got an interesting parallel, which is that when I was at school, I had a master that had come from the world of advertising into teaching, and it was incredibly different to almost every other teacher that, I mean, I'm not going to say he was an inspiration or any of that stuff. He just had a totally different approach because he'd been doing something else. And, that meant he could bring different tools and different skills to the job and possibly a different perspective. And that's kind of what I'm sensing with Lisa.
Yeah, and her teams love working with her as well. She's got some very loyal support, and I think they find her quite inspiring to work with.
Now, talking about teams, how did this one work then? Because when this production started, I thought that Jacqueline was the designer.
I think they've split the episodes up, haven't they?
Yeah.
They're different stories. There's a number of stories. And rather than having one crew throughout, they split the heads of departments.
So it's sort of like how Black Mirror do it. A different episode has a different, completely different team and feel. I mean, Small Axe must have been really interesting for her as well, because, I mean, to be offering a production that actually you feel is talking about people in your life and your history and everything must be amazing to be able to recreate your childhood, as it were, as where you are currently looking back, to be able to actually have an interest back.
And she references that, the personal experience. And I think, when it, in context to how we all need to be thinking in the positive in terms of storytelling, and not just storytelling, but also the the creatives that put those stories together.
There's also been a degree of diversity within the business, but not as much as obviously we would all like.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we hope you've been enjoying these conversations. We definitely have been, and we've been enjoying your feedback. If you have any questions or queries for us, please email them to podcast@angels.co.uk. You can visit our website, which is www.angelsbehindtheseams.com, or you can find us on social media. We're on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook /costumepodcast. And here is Jonathan's chat with Lisa Duncan.
So, Lisa Duncan, welcome to Angels Podcast. I'm really thrilled that you've got the time in your busy schedule at the moment to have a chat with us about your career and work and aims and a little bit of insight.
Great. I mean, it's great to be here. So thank you. Thank you for asking.
I think one of the most important elements of what we do is the establishment of relationships and connections. And I've only just recently met you through your work coming into Angels and Angels supplying you with costume. I've noticed on the occasions that we've had to connect and deal with each other that there's a calm and an experience that makes me feel like, you know, we all work and under such pressure, and yet you're like a swan kind of floating around over the surface, and we know that everybody's legs are kind of like furiously paddling away trying to get it all together, and everybody's under such pressure with budgets and time and everything like that. It was actually that observation that made me curious and want to know more about how you function and operate. And I just wondered if you could take us back to that moment when you stepped into the arena and your world, you suddenly realized, clothing, fashion, history, costume.
Well, really, I mean, I actually studied fashion design when I left school. So I was always interested in clothes, but my interest in clothes actually came from watching films. I mean, I grew up kind of watching old Hollywood films, so I was always obsessed with costume and design, and went into fashion because I really didn't know of any courses that were kind of costume related back then. And I worked in fashion and actually ended up working in magazines and became a fashion editor. But I really remember thinking, I really want to do costume. At some point, I want to do costume for film, but I had no idea how to do that. And I moved to the States for a while with my family and lived in New York and worked there for a bit. And then when I was coming back 10 years ago, I made the decision to try and move into costume, basically. So I actually went and did an MA in costume design. That's how it...
Where did you do that?
I did that at LCF, London College of Fashion. And mainly, I mean, I looked at other courses, but that one seemed to be the right kind of course for me, but also it was the shortest. And I felt that I didn't want to spend 3 or 4 years doing a degree because I was coming into it kind of later. And it worked out really well. I mean, I really enjoyed the study, and it kind of cemented that decision for me to go into costume.
And was that a decision based? Did you put your life on hold in order to do the MA?
Yes.
How did you make that work? The work life balance in terms of family and.
Well, I was lucky. I'm lucky that basically I had the support of my husband, and he was working. Mm. And my children, my mum came and helped me, my children, which was great. She kind of came and helped out because when I first did the degree, that was really intense. And then I started working in short films and just doing anything and, you know, travelling and working on lower budget films that were very intense, you know.
Yeah.
And, small teams or no teams, basically, kind of often like me plus one person. So it was just like all hours, kind of crazy. But it was a great way to.
And what that teaches you, that I find so fascinating, going through this process of chatting to designers and establishing how they make their first inroads into the industry and all the different methods they're in. And I think one of the important points is that, if you like, as a more mature person entering the industry in the way that you did, having had a connected career but another career, means that your approach to the unquestionable amount of pressure that is placed upon us in order to kind of see the process through with the resources that we have is actually markedly different from somebody who comes into the business as a young student. And I think that's key, because I think what that then means is that your decision-making process in terms of how you initially are drawn to a project would be completely different.
I think so. I mean, for me, I definitely had transferable skills, because when I'd worked in fashion for a number of years, and so I dressed like models, real people, actors, singers, all kinds of people, dancers, and I had done commercials and the odd kind of music video. But I think having worked at that level in magazines, you do, you're learning to kind of manage budgets and work with teams and hair and makeup and you know, working with management as well. So basically I was coming into it having learned kind of skills, how to work with people and how to kind of negotiate and that kind of thing.
And the psychology of performers.
Yes.
So in terms of trying to, it's all very well having a very strong idea and vision and concept. It's how you transfer your passion and your vision into the psychobabble of a performer and then connect that all with the narrative.
Yeah.
And that's endlessly fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I'm definitely drawn towards kind of projects that have, some kind of social conscience or a kind of, and a really kind of interesting story. And I love character-led stories, and I do find myself getting really kind of passionate about projects that I do end up taking on, because for me, I think I'm lucky that I can consider which projects I want to do. But I think basically for me, it's all about collaboration. And at the end of the day, I have a lot of respect for actors. And I think that's partly why I've been quite successful in a short amount of time. So I work very closely with the actors and explain my vision for the character. And that seems to work really well, I think, because for me, just finding the character is so exciting. It's not just about kind of dressing somebody up and making them look kind of glamorous. That's kind of really easy. It's just when the actor feels that the character is there, that's when you know that you're on the right track.
I think that if we go back to when to the start of the conversation, and you said you were a mad film fan. Was there a genre of cinema or TV that attracted you most, that drew you in?
Strangely, I was obsessed with like kind of 1930s, 40s kind of Hollywood, especially 30s actually, as a child. And, those kind of old actors like kind of Betty Davis and just that classic old Hollywood, those kind of films.
Driven by strong characters.
Completely, yeah. And I used to analyse them. I mean, many of the films that I've seen over and over again. And I watch them and kind of analyse them and, just try and work out why they work, why the characters work. And I think that's probably what kind of drew me into, because fashion is just making people look beautiful and glamorous. But when I was doing fashion, I was actually would get more excited about the story, the shoots that were based on a film or some kind of character in history. So I was always kind of making those stories. And I've always loved the research as well. That's like one of my favourite parts of the job. I can't stop with research. I just keep going and keep going.
Does that entail the acquisition of books and magazines, or are you a hoarder of whatever you can get your hands on?
Hundreds of books. I mean, literally hundreds. I'm always buying books, and I do a lot of research online as well. But not everything's online. I mean, for it to be online, someone has to have taken a photograph and posted it. So I'm just always looking, and I'll find things and put them away and think, maybe I'll get a job that's kind of Victorian children, or, you know, so I'm always looking. And I actually do that with clothes as well, which is a problem. I found things in the past, like I'll be in a charity shop and see a 1970s babies, you know. I mean, I found a nylon christening robe and bought it just in case, you know. I'm kind of crazy like that. I will.
But you're so right to do that, because, you know, by virtue of what it is, it would have been considered a disposable garment, and it's a unique piece of time and place. And, you know, people held on to the heritage garments, you know, with, you know, if you're talking about christening robes, they would have held on to something passed down from an Edwardian era or earlier. But a nylon one, you know, that would have just been chucked out. So, but the story attached to that nylon robe, where did you find it?
I literally found it in a charity shop, and it was, I'm obsessed with charity shops. I can't walk past them, so I'm always looking at charity shops, and it was literally like £2, and I bought it. But in the past I've bought children's wear. I mean, whenever I find things, and then I have used it, weirdly enough, it's like a year later something comes up and I'll use it. But I do, you know, if it's something that you don't see that's rare, then I can't resist, you know. So luckily I have an attic and stuff. But yeah, but books especially, I'm constantly buying, or always looking, you know, in the history section to see if anyone's dashed away any interesting old costume books, because there are a lot that are out of print, aren't there, you know.
I think what's brilliant about these days in terms of research is that having like Google Images or Pinterest and, you know, all the Instagrams that can sow a seed, and you can be immersed in a world, and you type in the simplest kind of subject matter, and it can take you on a path that actually extends beyond what you're actually seeing online. And you know one imagines that everything is available to you online, in the same way that people used to pay money and go to the picture libraries, you know, the journalist picture libraries in Halton Press, and there used to be a place up in Colindale that was National Press Association, their library. And, you know, that would be the same thing. You would start there in the same way that you would use Google, and then and then that would take you on the journey if you had that mindset.
And time as well, that's the thing.
The time is the most important. It's interesting that you were mentioning about the films and taking that aspect of reference. I was also obsessed with cinema, and I used to watch films repeatedly, and still do. You know, there's always going to be something that I'll find. But what I tend to do now is I watch the films with the volume off, and you know, obviously you have to acknowledge that the script is a vital process in terms of the filmmaking storytelling. But when you know the film, and you've acknowledged what it is about the film, the aspect of the film that you love, there's something incredible about watching it with no sound, because you step into a different viewing dimension. In particular, I do that with a film, Gilda, which Rita Hayworth, and
I love Gilda.
You know, Glenn Ford. I know the film so well now, I could kind of like repeat the dialogue.
Do you take notes when you're watching something like that?
No, mental notes. I'm constantly thinking about, you know, what they're wearing and the circumstances with which they're wearing it. When you had a time and style that society demanded that you present yourself in a certain way.
Yeah.
I love the idea of the structure of dress within how it sits in society. When I say dress, I mean, you know, style of dress. That's the difference between, and in fact, probably slightly more straightforward in terms of process when you're trying to recreate it than doing contemporary work today, because it's boundaryless.
Yeah. Now, I mean, it's so true. I think from kind of 60s, 70s onwards, they're kind of similar to contemporary because, you know, there were less rules, but, you know, it's true when you go earlier than that, young people dressed a certain way, and then, you know, they would stay, you know, I mean, obviously teenagers came in the 1950s, didn't they? Before that, they wore their parents' clothes,
yeah,
didn't they?
Yeah.
So in some ways it feels like period could be easier, because I think when you're designing contemporary, everyone has an opinion of the way it looks, you know, somehow in design. And but with period, they're not as familiar, so they'd kind of take your word.
In your process with a contemporary production, knowing that that's, there is that propensity for people to kind of chip in and, oh, I wouldn't have done that, because they,
yeah,
they make it about themselves. And then perhaps in some cases, especially if it's the, you know, writer director, then you can understand that. Do you make sure that with every project that you take on, that you get that time with the director in order to, you know, process and clarify your journey,
yeah,
so that you can then transfer those thoughts in, you know, easily, or perhaps in a more straightforward way with a performer?
Yeah, I mean, always, you have meetings ahead, and, you know, I would go away and do my mood boards and come up with my kind of vision for the project. And then basically just explain my thoughts and how I came to that, how I came to those decisions for each character. And, you know, once you've kind of taken on their ideas, because sometimes, you know, when you go into a meeting, the director already has images,
sure,
and ideas about the characters. Often they don't. You know, once we've kind of clarified what we want and what we kind of agree on, you then kind of have to apply that to the actor, mm-hmm, because obviously the casting is so important. I might have an idea for a character, but it could then change completely depending on who they cast. So I would then meet with the actor, talk through the ideas that I've had, but I always kind of am really interested in their ideas, because they've been thinking solely about their character, whereas I'm thinking of everybody. So in some ways they might come up with ideas that I haven't thought about in relation to the way that character wears their clothes. So, you know, I love that part of kind of collaborating, and I would definitely kind of encourage that. I always encourage that, and like to kind of talk to the actors as much as possible and meet them ahead.
Mm.
And I would explain ideas that the director had had, and then we'll start the kind of fitting process and trying things on and seeing what works well.
At this stage, is it just you, or do you bring your assistant into that mix so that you're all, so that when it does get up and running, you're all on the same page?
Often for the initial meetings for the principal cast, it might be just me. It depends on when they're brought on. Some principal actors come on later in the prep kind of time. So, but often I might have the first meeting myself. It really depends on the actor, to be honest. It depends on the access, where you meet them. You know, you might have to go to meet them at their kind of home or hotel, or they'll come to us. If they come to us, then generally, you know, wherever we're working from, I would do it with my assistant. But I think sometimes it's good to get those initial kind of conversations as a one-to-one, you know,
yeah,
to talk about, yeah, the project as a whole. And also I like to kind of explain to them my thoughts about the other characters as well, because,
yeah,
especially with contemporary, it happens often that you'll get, the actors will go, well, I was thinking about a biker jacket for my character, or I was thinking of this. And then I have to explain that there might be another character who's already has that look. So it's about kind of making them understand that you really thought about all of the characters, and they're all quite individual and quite different. So I definitely like to kind of connect with them one-to-one first, if possible.
In terms of the process, and you can stop me if I can't say anything about small acts, but that's currently what you're working on.
Yeah.
And in terms of scale,
yeah,
it's, your career trajectory is impressive, because you've gone through the styling process, the, as you say, the fashion process,
yeah,
and then you've moved into narrative, and you've kind of worked your way through from small projects,
yeah,
and short films and commercials to, would you say that the point that you're at now is it, aside from being exactly where you should be,
yeah,
is absolutely part of the journey working for Steve McQueen?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'd actually kind of heard about this project a year and a half before I was kind of came on board. I loved his work. And I had heard that he was doing a TV drama that was based in the 1970s. So for me, you know, having lived through the 1970s, I was very excited about the idea of that. So I'd, you know, said to my agent, you know, I would love to, you know, that they'd mentioned it. And I just said, I would love to work on that. That would be just kind of like a dream project, because...
Get me in the room, get me in the room.
Basically, because, you know, all I knew was that it was based in London and, you know, 1970s. So I thought, well, that, you know, for me, that's kind of like, I didn't grow up in London, but my grandmother lived in London. So I visited throughout my childhood. And I just knew the characters. I was, you know, thinking about it a long time before. So eventually last spring, when I actually was kind of called in, I was sent the script ahead. And when I read it, I was just completely blown away because I had no idea what it was about. And, you know, it was an amazing opportunity for me. But I just felt, it just felt really, as a design project, just, I just knew it. It really felt like I knew who these characters were. It was just kind of people, you know, that I felt very comfortable with. And I just had, I could see them reading them. I mean, that's always the mark of a great script for me. If I read a script and I can literally visualise what they're wearing, and I start making notes as I go along, I can just see them. So,
and did Steve, as a visual artist, have fixed ideas of how he wanted to represent the drama through colours, or was it essentially more about the reality? So it wasn't in the abstract; it was actually naturalistic and very clear in terms of the world.
It was actually quite naturalistic. I mean, I basically, when I met with him, I'd done kind of my kind of preparation and research and mood boards, and just had basically designed the characters, that the world, the background and everything, and I just presented it to him, and he liked it. You know, he was I think he kind of, obviously these stories are based on kind of his experiences growing up, so it was a world that he knew very well, and I think there was just that kind of connection that he could see the characters. And, you know, some of them he just said, I remember my aunt's dressing like this when, you know, I was growing up. Yeah. So I think it was a good fit.
And so I suppose what I'm trying to say, because I'm very excited about the prospect of watching it, having seen how everything's been sort of pulled together over the last 6 months in terms of, you know, the stock that's been going out and the fittings that have taken place. Yeah. I wondered whether, knowing his work as an artist, I wondered whether there was an opportunity for him here to sort of say, yes, I recognise my aunts, and that's exactly how I want them to look, but I want it in yellow, or, you know, bring out the orange in it. Was it that detailed, or was it much more simplistic than that?
He actually didn't do that. To be honest, I had a kind of idea about a kind of colour palette that I just, my memories of that era, and I had kind of presented a colour palette that I liked for my episodes, and he was happy with it. So it really did kind of go along ridiculously kind of. But fortunate, I felt, that he just liked it. He liked what he saw, so he was quite happy to go along with that.
There's a serendipity, but it also, it's you're giving him, you as the designer, are bringing a visual aspect, and it's your effort. So, you know, you mustn't ever kind of dismiss the luck is what you make it, but it's not just about luck. It's about people's process, and obviously what you brought to the table at that initial meeting clicked, and that enables you then to kind of go off on your journey and make the experience as special as it obviously has become.
Yeah, I mean, I think it all comes down to the research at the end of the day, and I did, you know, so much research, and talking about the internet versus books as well, you do have to be careful, because sometimes they're mislabeled date wise and we were so strict with the dates, because, you know, the series goes from the 1960s through to the 80s, but my episodes are 1968 to 71, so it's very specific. And that was quite a small kind of time scale that we felt that we had to be really kind of close to. So I mainly basically looked at kind of 1960s images. Mm. But yeah, it was down to the research, but also family photos. And I'd talk to my dad and asked him what he was wearing at the time. But I could just remember seeing images of my, you know, family, and it would just jog my memory. Like, there are a couple of characters that who I love, who I basically completely base them on family members, and I was insistent that they had to have not tights but pop socks that were worn to the knee, and, you know, like details like that. Kind of, you know, we went shopping in Brixton and areas that would kind of have those kind of.
It's amazing that they're still available to.
Yeah, and actually there were kind of little old ladies coming up with their shopping trolleys buying their tights there, so that was kind of affirming that was a place to go.
North Road Market.
Yeah, East Street Market. I remember going, I mean, I used to go shopping at those places with my grandmother, following her around, and yeah, I used to love visiting her friends. I mean, that's the thing, I think as a costume designer, you have to be interested in people, and I've always been interested in people, anybody. I love people watching and trying to work out who they are and what their history is, so I'm endlessly fascinated by people, taking mental notes on what people are wearing and how they wear their clothes, how they fit as well. And I think that all kind of feeds into it, because you then have strong ideas that person's suit will be a little bit too tight for, you know, reasons that are in the script. And that person wears their clothes a little bit baggier. So it's just those kind of things I'm always thinking. And I think with contemporary, it's really important. Like, I've done jobs in the past where there's a group of young people that the costumes are all very similar, but they're slightly different. And it's getting that detail and that, the kind of nuance that makes it work for the character.
Yeah, that's the key responsibility. And I've said it, I've repeated myself in over the weeks, in the sense that every designer has an artistic vision, but being able to process that artistic vision in the clearest and most exciting way is only in the hands of a few. And I think I think we should all be striving to be as truthful and as, if you like, and combining that with an artistic endeavor to always push forward, you know, never be complacent. And I think that that's what the passion enables and drives. And it's interesting how then understanding the mediums that you're working within, whether it's television, film, or theatre, and how you can then best kind of portray the world through, whether it's the widescreen or the stage where people are. Yeah. That many more feet away from you.
Yeah, it still has to feel authentic. I mean, I'm always obsessed with trying to make the characters feel real, you know, like real people. That it's, you know, and it's very flattering when your actors feel, quite a few of the actors on Small Acts actually said, oh, you know, I would actually wear this. And I'm thinking, well, it's 1970s. But they just, I think what they meant was that it felt that it suited them.
Yeah. You know? They wouldn't have that. They wouldn't have the same language. They're putting themselves in their character, aren't they? And they're saying, I believe this.
Yeah, and it's all in the detail. But I think it, for me, fit is very important, and also proportion.
Yeah,
you know, that's the thing that I worked very closely with. That on a production of this size, you can't dress every person, even though I might want to, because I can be a bit control freak, but. You know, you have to trust other people to in the team to dress the crowd. And I, you know, I kept saying over and over, you know, that costume has to suit that person and that character. So not just about dressing everyone in a, you know, you don't just have a rail of 1960s jeans and hand them out. It has to be the right style of jeans for that person, that age and that character. Just making sure that people weren't putting a young person in something that I know would have been worn by an older person.
Yeah.
You know? So it's just really being aware of that, like thinking really hard. Because to me, the background are just as important as the main cast. The costumes are so important because that's what makes it feel real.
And not just in terms of the shooting moment, but then the broadcasting moment, the viewing moment where, you know, the eye is all over the piece. It's not, you know, I don't agree with the fact that all you're looking at is who's talking. You're taking in the whole scene. Yeah. So yeah, again, it's back to that responsibility. Bearing in mind that in terms of your career journey, this is a fairly recent evolution for you. How have you found meeting teams and collaborating with supervisors and assistants? Has that been an easy process? Is it something where, as you've got a job and so the job has enabled you, have you put a message out on social media, or how does it work for you?
Well, that has actually been kind of one of the hardest things, because when I first started out, you know, as I said, I was just doing, it was just me and an assistant, and it's, you know, it's not that hard to find assistants. But as the jobs got more pressured and more responsibility and bigger budgets, I needed then to find supervisors. And I hadn't worked with costume supervisors. So I just kind of, I did put an advert, I think, for the first film that I did on, the first big film, on Facebook, on a kind of costume networking group. Mm. And I got so many replies, literally like 120 probably.
Wow.
Because then I didn't realize, I'd literally got people offering to fly themselves in from Australia to be an assistant, you know. I did find an amazing supervisor, but then that's the tricky thing. I interviewed a few, but I think when you're coming into it without, you know, lots of credits, the people that are more established don't necessarily want to kind of leave the comfort of working in a team that they're quite happy in. And also people are busy. So that was kind of hard, but I was really lucky. I did find some great people. And I think, you know, I'm used to working with lots of people and meeting different people. So I think I don't mind working with new people, but it is harder. And it's harder, you know, you can't take all the responsibility on yourself. You do need to be able to delegate. And that's the great thing about building up a team and working with people that who know your taste and the way that you work. But having not been anybody's assistant, it's been hard to kind of learn how a truck runs. And, I think...
I'm full of admiration for the kind of... As I started the chat was the sort of the seemingly effortless way in which you're able to push through when there are so many factors that go into the process. Yeah. And I think that to have that ability to sort of glide over it and focus on the artistic element is very important. Otherwise, you just become bogged down with the minutiae of work that just doesn't connect.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. I think I'm kind of quite good at working with people and kind of bringing people together. I hope. I mean, But it can be difficult because, you know, there are politics that kind of arise on set and within departments. But I just, you know, I like everyone to have a good time as well. But it's really hard work. The hours are very, very long. And, you know, I am prepared to put that time in and work hard. So I think that's how I've managed to kind of keep going and to kind of get new projects is just working so hard. It really is hard work, you know, and very long hours. Just learning from everyone around me. I mean, I could have a trainee or an assistant that has come off of, you know, Star Wars or something. So everyone brings something.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to hear everyone's advice and find out what they've learned that I haven't learned, you know.
Within your process, now that you've discovered a company like Angels in the sense that, you know, the potential of what can be achieved within the stock and... Has that shifted your, you know, are you still as anxious to make sure that you get the item from the charity shop when there's every possibility that the item, even though it's not yours, the item can be found and supplied from somewhere?
Yeah, I think I've learned that. I think initially when I was starting out, I was on such low budget projects that I just would never have been able to afford to borrow, you know, to hire. But I had years, I mean, over the years, I have borrowed from Angels for commercials and those kind of, you know, and occasionally if I needed uniforms, I would then hire uniform or like, you know, anything kind of that wasn't available to buy. But I think, yeah, it was just literally I was doing jobs that were like, the budget was like £500. So, you know, to dress kind of many people. So there was no way. It was just kind of charity shops or nothing. Mm. But I have found, especially in the last few weeks that I've been based, that I'm learning where everything is. You know, I've had a chance to kind of look around and really have a go through your stock and find all kinds of things, which has been really, really interesting, actually. And I think it's made me realise, you know, as you go on, the jobs get bigger, you just don't have time.
Yeah.
I don't have time to do all that shopping. You know, I can't, because then I'm not available to, you know, I'm not going to be able to spend enough time on set. And I do need to be on set more, probably, going forward, because I'm missing, you know, I'm missing out otherwise. I'm not there to kind of see. I need to be there when actors are kind of starting. And often with television and with film, you know, as I said before, you have actors joining the production all the way through. So I think going forward, I would definitely like to kind of be based more in one place and not have to do all the shopping myself.
Yeah.
And that's actually something that, you know, worked quite well for me on Small Axe. We rented a huge amount, but we had so many crowd days where we needed a big volume of costumes that it was kind of helpful to have people shopping for us as well. Mm. So I think...
And that centralisation.
It makes it so much easier, I think, yeah. Because I think in some ways I was kind of in danger of burning out, like spending every single day shopping for weeks and weeks and weeks. And also, you don't always find great things. So it's kind of... I need to kind of be able to delegate more. Mm. It's great to be in one place for longer and just be really able to kind of take your time and calmly just put those, you know, put the wardrobes together for all of your characters without kind of the chaos of trying to get across London. And
I always think that what a stock like Angels can offer is, as aside from the physical item itself, there's also the opportunity to be inspired by a piece of knitwear or a shirt or, you know, trousers that could then lead to something else.
Yeah.
Of course, you have to afford yourself the time, which on the one hand, by centralizing yourself in a place like this, you have that time. But also it's about consolidating your thoughts. And I remember on a couple of episodes that Jacqueline was doing, where they'd found exactly the right shape of dress, for example. Yeah. In fact, in this instance, it was a dress. So they found the right dress, but they couldn't find the right colour. And fortuitously, they managed to find some amazing fabric. And it was a very easy process to then kind of, if you like, walk it from the warehouse through into the making rooms and, you know, have it recreated.
That's a great resource, it really is.
Yeah, and the makers love the idea of, you know, of course they always love to see pictures and drawings, and but they also love the idea of having the original garment, regardless of whether it fits the person that's going to be wearing it. That's kind of, you know, that's irrelevant. But to see something physically in front of them as they're making up their patterns is part of the reason why, you know, they're here and they've chosen this path is in terms of a workroom rather than sort of their own isolated pocket somewhere in a, you know, in an industrial estate.
Yeah, and I mean it's such a great skill to be able to take a pattern from a garment without taking it apart.
Yeah,
is amazing. Yeah. It's amazing that you can do that, and also people are bigger, aren't they? You know, that's the thing. We did find that we'd see these amazing garments, but no one was going to fit them. Like some of the, you know, 1960s trousers, the waist measurements on them was, you know, just so tiny.
For women as well as men.
Yeah, I mean, some of the men's trousers were tiny. 26 waist. I know. Women, you know, and it's like, obviously we're all different sizes and shapes, but it's like people now, we're all bigger.
Well, it's,
yeah, you'd see this incredible garment and want to copy it.
The interesting thing is that when I look at a pair of, especially actually the 70s, I don't know what kind of diet people were on, but the proportion of their waist to their hip, to their seat, just bears absolutely, it's inches and inches and inches apart from away from where we are now. It's quite amazing. And you find something like that for a woman, Marks and Spencer's St. Michael's size 10, but there's absolutely no, that would now be a 6.
Yes, definitely. It's like, I mean, that's why we walk round Angels endlessly with our tape measures on, because every single item has to be measured.
Yeah.
You know, we have to take measure out because they're just so different. And, you know, if, as you're saying, body shapes have changed. They're just so, some of them, that the jackets and dresses are so narrow. Mm-hmm. So you know that you're not going to get them on, you know. I mean, then occasionally we did actually have, one of our actors did have a 26 waist, one of our men, which was fantastic because he had the pick of everything, you know. But most people don't have that. Yeah. So we did have to get some things kind of made, but it's amazing. I mean, my next job coming up is theatre, so I probably will do that most likely, is actually find period things and then get them.
Yeah, you'll have to recreate, just because of the, you know, the arduous process of daily shows. And
exactly, because we'll need multiple, so I think that's definitely going to be the process there. But it's like finding that inspiration and, you know, those garments that fascinates me is that you see garments that you've never seen before. Mm. I love that. You know, when you find something, you think, do people, I've never seen anything like that, you know, and you've not seen in the references at all, which is exciting.
Yeah, but we're back to the point that you need to base yourself on the reference in order to then know where you can take that, and your field of reference has to be, it's like when, you know, you go for an interview and the producer or director say, now, you know, this is a period production, but we don't want it to look period.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, what does that actually mean? what are you supposed to do with that? And but what they're trying to say is that we don't want a bland recreation of history. We want intense characterization, heighten the narrative. Yeah, yeah. But they don't use that vocabulary. They just kind of come out with this sort of rather crass comment that gives you no help whatsoever.
Yeah. I mean, that can be difficult because you have to try and interpret that, don't you?
Yeah. And I would throw it back onto them and sort of, great, but what do you actually mean by that? You know, make them try and express themselves, because you'll go away, and or one will go away, and the process will be finding everything out about the 1930s, which will then enable you to sort of take it off into a different direction, depending on the kind of person that you're trying to, you know, portray.
Yeah, I think also as well with research with period, if you don't bring in other kind of elements into your research, then you're really showing the same pictures as everybody else, aren't you? So everyone's going to have the same references. So you do have to try and find other resources, and whether it is fabric or photographs of garments, I think it's hard in some ways. You know, there is that element of trust that obviously that has to come, because between you and the director and the producers, because otherwise they don't really know what you're going to come up with unless they've seen what you've already done, something of the same period. And that's quite hard, you know. I mean, it's, for me, coming from, I have done a lot of contemporary, if people haven't seen that you've done that period, then they might think that you can't do it. But of course, you know, there's no one around who was working in Victorian times or anything, so we're all researching, aren't we, doing our research. But it's just, I think for me, colour's really, really important. I'm obsessed with colour, and I think the combinations of colour, and I like to find a colour palette initially, but also certain characters wear maybe a different colour. So that can kind of really define the characters. But I think often for producers and directors, they don't necessarily imagine as much colour as there was in that time, you know, because we see so many black and white pictures, so they might actually be shocked. Mm. They may imagine them being too colourful. But I think for me, it's important to have all of those conversations ahead and to show examples and references, and, you know, so that you're everyone's convinced way ahead.
Yeah.
You know, that there aren't surprises.
Yeah.
So you don't get a situation like someone asked me last year, what happens if an actor refuses to wear a costume? And I said, well, that's not really happened, because I would have discussed it with them ahead and I would have explained it, you know, my choices ahead. So I don't want to get into that situation where the director goes, what, you know, why is that person wearing that? Or they just go, no, I hate that. But you've just got to work all of that out ahead as much as possible.
Yeah, that's a very difficult question. Have you ever had a performer that's refused to wear? Like, it's like, at what stage would you imagine a performer would refuse to wear something? Because if you've done your job, then you've had that conversation right from the very start, and they've been as immersed in your world as you have. And I think it's like, yes, they could perhaps refuse to wear something when you're at your fitting stage, and that's exactly what that process is all about.
Yeah.
So in that context, great, because you're getting feedback.
Yeah.
But oh my goodness, the thought that somebody would refuse to wear something when it's already been worked out and is about to be established, that's very scary.
That would be too. Yeah, and also, well, too expensive. We're all working with budgets, and if it's something that's been potentially made, and we might have had multiples made, we can't risk that. You know, it all has to be kind of agreed, and also, you know, in the fitting, you take photographs and show them. They can see how it looks and why it works for that character, and everyone kind of ahead has that confidence that it's going to work. So we have to plan all of that. It's all in the planning, isn't it? So that's why you hope that you have enough prep time.
Yeah. How do you feel about how do you embrace technology in terms of not just the electronic technology that we have at our fingertips that we use to kind of communicate with photographs and internet, but in terms of the concept of, you know, 3D printing and technology and recreation, is that something that you're looking forward to having the opportunity of embracing, or does that, in terms of using that to feed into your story, does that kind of like, does it do nothing for you?
I'm open to anything, to be honest. I'm always interested in learning new things. So, I mean, for me, I mean, I love having things handmade and embroidery, anything like that. If you can afford it, is amazing. But 3D printing, I think, is fascinating. So I think definitely, if we're able to reproduce things in a way that makes them, you know, like armour or embroidery or anything, if we can do that in a way that doesn't involve 100 hours and, you know, impossible costs, then I'm completely open to exploring new ways of making things, definitely.
Finally, to wrap us up, what would be like a single piece of advice that you'd offer somebody who's coming into the business and hasn't been an assistant and has got a clear idea of the journey that they want to go on?
I would say, I think what's really important is basically making connections and kind of, I think basically just kind of being prepared to kind of learn from everyone that you meet, and just stay really focused and quite determined. And I think, to be honest, for me, it's all been about the relationships that I've made along the way and the people that I've worked with. And I think just kind of building up those contacts has probably been what's kind of led me here. And also be prepared to just do, you know, do what it takes to get there. You're not always going to, you're not going to start on high budget jobs. You're really not. But if you meet people who you think are passionate and smart and creative and interesting, go for it. I mean, I've done low paid short films, student films, just because they were interesting and had a great script. So I think if you're passionate about the work, you've got to learn somewhere, and you're much more likely to be given the opportunity to design a low budget project. And you can make great contacts as well through that. Don't expect to just jump in on those jobs.
No, that's amazing. That's amazing advice, because first of all, it's, you know, the maturity in the sense that you've been there and done certain things that can cut out a huge amount of bullshit, if you like, because you got to that point. If you could do what you were doing now, if you could have done it earlier, would you? Is that what you would have done? Would you have gone straight into costume design rather than the world of fashion?
I think I would, to be honest. Yeah, if I had known, if I'd known about costume design as a kind of career, I don't remember seeing costume design courses. I think there might have been theatre design kind of combined courses, but although I love interiors, I always wanted to just do fashion and costume. You know, I wouldn't. Mm. So I wouldn't have wanted to do both, because to me they're quite different. I know that there are people who are very successful doing both, but I think, yeah, if I had known of a great costume course, I definitely would have jumped at the chance to do that. But I really didn't know. I didn't even know what a fashion editor was when I started out. I mean, I started out in fashion design, so I just kind of fell into it in a way. But yeah, I mean, I love costume. This is my dream job. I absolutely love what I do. And I think that having that passion for something really does drive you on. And, you know, there's nothing I'd rather be doing.
Well, it's very infectious, because I see your passion when I've kind of surveyed the scene through the weeks of work. And I'm actually looking forward to the short film that we helped you on about
the Harlem Hellfighters. Yeah, that was a really interesting one.
Yeah. Lisa, thank you so much. It's been really fun talking to you, and I'm glad we've met, and I'm glad you were able to join our roster of designers.
No, but it's been wonderful and so helpful. I mean, the support has been great, because we have been running around in a very just in a not the normal team, as it were. So it's been great.
What a scary new world.
Yeah, it's been great to have the help to, you know, the support of your kind of team.
So that was Jonathan's chat with Lisa Duncan. Great interview, and more information about someone and their process that I don't really work with a lot. I've only come into contact once or twice in the building, and it was fascinating to hear her whole process and her story.
Yes.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, and it was really enjoyable. And I thought, and it was interesting, you touched on that thing that I thought we ought to expand on at some point, about the different sizing and the different shapes and things, which is making a big difference to what we do, and indeed what we can do with some of the costumes that we've got.
It's an interesting question, because I've always had people say people weren't smaller back then. It's just the clothes that are left are obviously the ones that people weren't wearing the most. But people were smaller back 50 years.
Shape was very
Shapes of bodies have changed, as you will see from going down the racks and looking at what would have been considered a Marks and Spencer's size 10 today wouldn't fit size 8. And it's not because it's been washed and shrunken. The structure of sizing is completely different. And the other thing to back up that theory is that shoe sizes, feet sizes have completely changed. And
well, men's physical shape. I mean, unfortunately, you've got this massive trend at the moment where a lot of men are human triangles. They're doing a lot of gym work, and their upper body is much bigger than it ever used to be. And you notice it more with the military things, Richard, when the customers come in with people who are a size 48 chest to be in the army, and something, it's just crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the commercial decision to resize or rebrand sizes so that, you know, somebody who wants would be a 14 is now, you know, considered a size 8 or however that one works is one thing, but the actual changing of shapes and as you say, people working out, getting far more sort of gym buff, which just didn't, you know, those shapes to my eye just don't work for period costumes sometimes, and it is a problem.
Well, it's always a problem when it comes to a period production where you get crowd who just do not look like people and it stands out, because when casting directors do get it right and they do cast people that look like they've stepped out of the time of the storytelling, i.e. you know, 1940s, 1950s, when people were starving and malnourished and it reflected in their, you know, in the pallor of their skin and the hair and the body shapes, and it's when it's right, it's such a joy.
Yeah. But to a certain extent, you're right, Jeremy. You know, if you made a range of clothes, then the ones that would sell most readily would be the average sizes, the sort of 38, 40, 42 chest jackets, and the 36s and the 34s, in which there'd be a proportion made, maybe wouldn't sell. So that sometimes that's what we're getting hold of, or what we've got. But no, it's interesting. And let's not even go about tattoos, shall we?
Well, the next interview we're going to be releasing is my interview with Matt Lucas. This is going to be our first sort of interview with someone outside of the costume world, and it's
but
a
very
great
connected,
but incredibly connected to the world of costume. Yeah,
and Matt graciously, actually, I talked to him for quite a while, and we go into a lot of things about his approach, because he's not just an actor; he's also a writer and creator as well. With a lot of the things he appears in before the acting properly kicked off, he was always in characters he'd created. So it's a fascinating insight into how he approaches costume and how it fits in. And I'm looking forward to introducing it all. So here is a small extract from my interview with Matt Lucas.
We've been very lucky to have brilliant costume and makeup people around who could work with us, present ideas. And like I say, you don't really realize how good they are until you work with someone who isn't good or who isn't on your wavelength. And then you go, Oh crikey! Okay. Because you just end up having to do all that work yourself, and you never do it as well as a great costume designer.